For me, genetics, as you talk about, is the genetic blueprint, and trying to treat the body without it is like getting your IKEA box delivered, and you've got all these millions of parts, but you don't have the instruction piece or what the product is supposed to look like.
You're listening to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, your home for holistic, evidence-based cognitive enhancement strategies. And now your host, Eric Levi.
Hey, welcome back to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, where we discuss holistic cognitive enhancement. My name is Eric, the Holistic A-Hole. I'm a functional nutritional therapy practitioner. Today on the podcast, I have Dr. Penny Kendall Reed. Penny Kendall Reed is a naturopathic doctor in Toronto. After graduating from McGill University in neurobiology, she earned a degree in naturopathic medicine from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine. Here she received the Dr. Alan Tyler Award for Most Outstanding Clinician. Penny Kendall Reed is the author of 5 national best-selling books, including The New Naturopathic Diet, Healing Arthritis, The No Crave Diet, The Complete Doctor's Stress Solution, and The Complete Doctor's Back Bible. In 2013, she was voted Naturopath of the Year by her peers and colleagues, and in 2018 was the recipient of the Top Naturopathic Doctor Award in Canada. Dr. Kendall Reed travels the world lecturing on the following topics: genetics and how to interpret and treat single nucleotide polymorphisms, neuroendocrine disorders, and metabolic-related diseases, and is the creator of an integrated genetic platform, GeneRx.ca. She appears regularly on television, magazine, and radio across Canada and the United States addressing various health issues. Dr. Kendall Reed analyzes and interprets genetic profiles and uses them to design personalized health programs for patients worldwide. She is an international medical consultant for Douglas Laboratories and Pure Encapsulations, creating product formulations and overseeing the neurometabolic department. Dr. Kendall Reed is a member of the scientific board for Pure Genomics and presently is the director of natural therapies at the Urban Wellness Clinic in Toronto. So before we get into it, I just want to give you a quick reminder. If you are new to the podcast, please remember to subscribe. It's really easy. All you got to do is just hit the subscribe button right there in your podcast player in your phone. It's right there in front of you. It's probably in your hand right now. Or if you'd like, if you've been here before, please leave a nice review. If you are new to nootropics or you want to learn more about using supplements, diet, and lifestyle to hack your brain for peak performance, make sure you go check out holisticnootropics.com, where we're also going to have all the show notes to this podcast, and that's going to be at holisticnootropics.com/podcast. So with no further ado, everybody, enjoy my talk today with the one and only Dr. Penny Kendall Reed.
Genetics is our foundation. It is our background. Just because we have a gene doesn't mean that we're going to express it. So that's really my job, is to look at how somebody codes for a gene and say, this is fantastic. I want to keep that expression of that gene turned on and that function turned on. This one, not so good. I want to help turn that one off. But with respect to mental health and cognition and function, it completely explains why two people can go into a stressful event, whether it is a soldier returning back from war or whether it's just a stressful event at work. One person goes and has a panic attack or has PTSD coming home from war, and the other person seems absolutely fine. And you're looking at it going, well, they were exposed to the same situation. Why aren't we reacting in the same way? And genetics completely explains it, from the amount of hormone we make for each stressor, how quickly we get rid of that hormone in our body, how quickly we shut off further production of our stress pathway and stress hormones and keep us in that stress state. It even dictates how quickly we will sink a memory into our brain and consolidate that memory so that we don't let go of it. It's absolutely fascinating, genetics, how it applies to the brain.
That's real.
And the body.
Of course. So it's like genes are really, you know, the way I describe it, between the interplay of genetics and epigenetics, it's like genes are the blueprint. Genes are the building plan. And then, Exactly. You know, what goes in the building and what happens in the building, that's more epigenetics.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We can't change our genes. Well, except for stress can actually starting to change our genes. But traditionally, we can't change our genes. What you were born with, if you code what's called, let's say, homozygote variant, you're going to be variant your whole life. The difference is, Are you expressing that gene? Are you making the protein that that gene is supposed to make and therefore having the side effect of that variance? Or are you turning off that expression and negating it? So what we do, the epigenetics, is that turning on and off of those genes.
You mentioned stress has the ability to turn on and off genes.
Stress can actually turn on or off or alter the expression of over 90% of our genes. It is one of the biggest lifestyle variables that affects our body. And unfortunately, right now, most of North America is expressing too much stress hormone just because of everything that's, you know, continually going on in our world. A really good example of this was done in mice first. And what they did was they took a group of mice and they conditioned the mice to the smell of acetone with a foot shock. And every time the smell of acetone came in their cage, they would deliver a foot shock and the mice would shudder. So just like Pavlov's dog, they got to the place where all they would have to do is put the acetone in the cage. There was no foot shock and the mice started shuddering. What they also noticed, though, is that the amount of cortisol in their body and the anxiety response was significantly higher, but it also started to increase the number of receptors, they're called M17 receptors, that pick up the smell of acetone. And so what was happening is these mice started developing a greater ability to pick up acetone at a further away distance or in smaller concentrations as a way of trying to avoid this foot shock. Three generations later, when none of those mice had been exposed to any acetone or any foot shocks, what they did is they put acetone in the cage again of three generations mice later. They started shaking just like their ancestors did. And they also had an increased number of M17 receptors, so an upregulation of that gene. So it shows you how we can completely change the expression of a gene with that stress. But newer studies are even showing we actually are changing the genes itself. And this was actually last year, there was two American twins. One was an astronaut and one wasn't. One went up into space for several months. He came back 7% different DNA than his twin because the amount of cortisol up there, cortisol will actually cross the nuclear membrane, bind onto messenger RNA, alter the messenger RNA, and change DNA transcription. I know. So if you think about, you know, we're all exposed to stress on a daily basis, all day long, what we're doing to our bodies.
Well, I think it's interesting too. Like when we talk about stress, I think most people, when they think about stress, they put stress into this one bucket, which is emotional stress, right? You think about my stress at work, my stress in my relationship, my stress, whatever your stress is. And now we're stressed out by looking at our phones and stressed out by watching the news. But then we kind of leave out this whole other piece of the pie, which is your physical stress. How is your environment physically stressing you out? You know, what are the chemicals that are in your, I was talking to Dr. Hellman about this in a previous podcast where, you know, we're talking about stress in plastics.
100%. I was actually just writing a detoxification genetic lecture and some of the papers that I was reading, just spending 3 months in Los Angeles, in the city of Los Angeles, is enough to increase interleukin 6, one of our main inflammatory substrates, up and above normal levels. Just walking around. That's it. In 3 months. Yeah. And then interleukin 6 goes and binds to pretty much every receptor in the body and blocks its ability to function, amongst a bevy of other things.
And what you're saying is with the interplay of genetics is that these stresses physically get imprinted on your coding and the body upregulates the stress response. And not only are you kind of destined to feel this for the rest of your life, but you're going to pass this on to your children.
Exactly right. And their children and so on and so on. Now there are certain things that we can do to start to break that cycle. But you have to be really aware of it and you have to know your genes because particularly when you're looking at serotonin and dopamine and cortisol and adrenaline, there is so much crossover between symptoms. Is the depression coming from low serotonin or is it actually more of an anxiety? They fight the flight side of fight or flight that is producing the low serotonin-like symptoms, but it's really coming from the stress hormones. And until you know your genes, you're just guessing. And that's why so many people go on antidepressants. And not only do they not feel better, they actually feel worse because we're targeting the wrong hormone. And genetics, again, allows us to really get specific with that treatment, see where things are coming from and get at the root cause of problems.
Right. That, I mean, so this is a big thing in the nootropic space, which is, you know, which nootropic works best for me, which substance works best for me. And, you know, the first place people go is they go online and they go looking for reviews and they see somebody says, oh, you know, N-acetyl-L-tyrosine, you know, helped me so much, but then they don't read, you know, the five reviews under it, which was like N-acetyl-tyrosine didn't work at all for me. N-acetyl-tyrosine made me feel worse. N-acetyl-tyrosine gave me more anxiety. And, you know, to me, that's a bit of a mystery. And it kind of goes back to my whole idea that we're all bio-individual, we all work differently. But, you know, bringing you in now, you're talking about, well, we can actually look at the genetic level and read, are you a good candidate for something like N-acetyl-L-tyrosine or even the next step up? You know, are you right for something like an SSRI?
So when you're looking at taking an amino acid like a tyrosine as a precursor to a neurotransmitter, let's take, because tyrosine will also go into dopamine. So let's take a look at dopamine production. Unless you know how much dopamine you make, how you transport that dopamine through the body or particularly through the brain, and then how you clear it out, you can really mess somebody up. So let's take that tyrosine, which goes into dopamine production. We'll also go into serotonin, but it goes greatly into dopamine. Dopamine, to keep that focus, that concentration, we want to keep all of that dopamine up here in the prefrontal cortex, particularly in and around the hippocampus. So we have that good focus concentration. But dopamine is sort of like a Goldilocks hormone. Too low, not good. A little bit, perfect. Too much, not good again. So if your low depressive symptoms or low motivation symptoms are not coming from dopamine, and you give somebody a dopamine precursor, what they're going to do is take all that dopamine from the prefrontal cortex, move it to the sides, move it to the anterior striatum, and that's our big emotional response. So now we've taken this person who was just really low motivated from the wrong place, and now we've really heightened their emotional response to things. And we see a lot of this with ADD drugs or ADHD drugs. Once again, when they're targeting the wrong place, it really hyperstimulates those kids or even adults. And we have to get the right neurotransmitter there. Similarly with serotonin, if serotonin is genetically not your issue, but you're still having low, quote, serotonin depressive-like symptoms, you can easily put someone to serotonin syndrome, which is, again, where they have sweats and increased heart rate and increased blood pressure and all this stimulation because we boost serotonin above normal. So really knowing what to target becomes key.
I mean, this is my big issue with something like 5-HTP, because people will jump to 5-HTP when they feel depressed, you know, because again, there's a lot of clinical studies that absolutely, I mean, it's just science. 5-HTP turns into serotonin, but it's like you said, we forget about serotonin syndrome. And if you get too much of it in the brain, these molecules, they could dock to a serotonin receptor, but they could also dock to any other number of receptors. So when they say the side effect of an SSRI is more depression or suicidal thoughts, that's actually an effect. That's actually a main effect. It's not a side effect.
100%, exactly. And that's when we're using an SSRI in the wrong individual. Their serotonin uptake through a gene called 5-HTTLPR is completely normal. So they don't need extra uptake. So if you're encouraging uptake when all the other real serotonin receptors are full, it's got to go somewhere else. It's going to bind into a wrong receptor and create all of that chaos.
So could you say that gene at 5-HTTPLR?
It's 5-HTTLPR.
LPR, okay.
So, and it's a gene that talks about the transportation of serotonin, one transportation of it out of the gut, and then up into the brain and up into receptors, but the transportation basically into the receptor all through the body. And it has what's called two versions, an L and an S, a long and a short. And the long version, which is considered the normal allele, it has a longer uptake, so it'll have a bigger effect. The short allele, or the short side of that gene, has a shorter uptake. So if they're given an SSRI, even if they need it, they need a much higher dose because they keep kicking it back out at a much faster rate.
I listen to, you know, a lot of podcasts, and I get really into this genetics conversation. And maybe, you know, maybe we can take a step back because I want to go deep into this genetics conversation.
So if we go back to our basic DNA, it's a double helix. So it has those two strands that twirled around each other. And there was a each pair of base nucleotides. So there's those four letters, A, C, G, and T. That's what made up each of those strands. And they were always paired together, two of the letters. When a cell replicates, it actually makes a complete replica of one side of the DNA strand and then divides itself in two so that it should have an exact copy of itself. But if by chance stress has targeted it, or it just makes what I call like a typo, a mistake in the recipe, if you will, for making that new DNA strand, it swaps out one letter, so a C for a G perhaps, one of the other base nucleotides. So now it's changed the information that is encoded in that DNA. And the series of base nucleotides down the DNA, it encodes for a recipe to make a protein, and that protein does a specific job in the body. So if we change that recipe of that protein because we've swapped out one base nucleotide, we've now changed the recipe for the protein and it makes a completely different protein. That swapping out of the base nucleotide is called a SNP, or a single nucleotide polymorphism, because we swapped out one base nucleotide for another base nucleotide. Of those four letters, so when we have a chromosome and when we are being created by our parents, for each chromosome, there's two letters, two of those base nucleotides, either an A, a C, a G, or a T. So our parents, let's say it'll be for gene NR3C2, which has to do with stress, which we might talk about. So C and T are two alleles there. We take one allele, one of those letters from each parent. So there's a bunch of different combinations that you could have there, depending on what your parents code. So if you take one C from one parent and one C from another parent, then you are a homozygote variant for that one gene, because the C is the bad allele for NR3C2. Because you've taken both genes from both parents, or both alleles of those genes from both parents, that carry the risk factor. So homozygote, meaning the same, variant, meaning the not as good allele. If you took both of the normal alleles from those genes, the TT, then you would be homozygote, meaning the same, T and T, normal. Or you could have taken one of each, and that's called heterozygote. Most often, almost about 95% of the time, being homozygote normal is the best position, but not always. There's certain genes where you want to be heterozygote. There's certain genes where you want to actually be variant. Depends on what that gene does and its function in the body. But most often, the less risk allele is the normal allele.
And that's the heterozygote?
That's the homozygote normal. So heterozygote means it has one normal allele and one variant allele in that coding.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So great. So that's like a good primer for the rest of the conversation. So getting back into, you know, how these genes interplay again with something like dopamine. So you might have the SNP that makes you process dopamine real quickly, right? Mm-hmm. So you have dopamine in for a little bit and then it's gone. That doesn't mean there's necessarily something wrong with you. It's just you kind of have to play within the boundaries
exactly.
of your SNPs.
And this is where, so what I do is the integration of genes. I don't treat gene by gene. So the gene that you're talking about there that helps clear out dopamine, there's a couple of them, but the main one is COMT, which we sort of, you know, we're chit-chatting about before the show. And COMT is a gene which clears out or breaks down dopamine, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and estrogen. So if you are normal for that gene, you clear out dopamine really, really quickly. So there's less available dopamine around to bind up into the receptors and have an effect. You also clear out your adrenaline, noradrenaline, which bodes well from a stress point of view, just not as well from a dopamine point of view. But you also have to marry that with how much dopamine are you making? So there's two different genes, DRD2 and DRD2 ANK1. And they talk about how much dopamine you make and how many dopamine receptors you have. So you might be clearing it out quickly, but you might make a ton of dopamine through both of those genes and have a ton of dopamine receptors. So it kind of balances. And that person generally doesn't get into too much dopaminergic trouble. Whereas the person who doesn't make much dopamine, and they have very few dopamine receptors, and they're clearing out their dopamine really quickly, they're dopamine deprivant all the time. Mm-hmm. Those are the addictive behaviors, the alcoholics, the drug users, definitely ADD, ADHD, taking it up to another level. They have a very difficult time focusing, but they also receive, because dopamine is our pleasure hormone, our reward hormone, they get very little pleasure from everyday sort of mundane things. They require really big highs in order to feel that pleasurable high. And that's where they start to get into the addictive substances and just to feel. So you can see how a lot of genetic platforms that are out there, they'll say, oh, well, you're comp variant, so you've got a ton of dopamine, don't worry about it. And then you're DRD2, you're also variant, you don't make a lot of dopamine, so you need to treat that. Well, as somebody reading that, what do you do? Do you not worry about the dopamine, or do you treat the dopamine? And that's why you really have to look at how all of the genes interact together. And that's, in my opinion, is the only responsible way to treat genetics.
Yeah, because I use several different genetics reports, and they do tell you only really in isolation. And it's like that, here's the gene and here's what you need to do. Here's the gene and here's what you need to do. And then a lot of times you find contradictory genes. You have genes that make you prone to obesity, and then you have genes that say you're prone to be really good at exercise.
So that's why I spent years and years creating a platform and writing hundreds and thousands of different algorithms of different combinations and variations with different genes, because that's the only way that you can really successfully treat them.
So when you say you have an algorithm, is that like a platform online that somebody can
go
to?
Yeah, so I have a platform called GeneRx.ca, and it addresses dietary, metabolic, exercise, inflammation, immune, detoxification, all neurotransmitters, sex hormones, thyroid, so everything, but from an integrated level. So there'll be sort of 5 or 6 genes in each section, all talking about whether it's stress hormones, whether it's dopamine, etc., what that person codes specifically for each of those genes, and how their specific coding interacts with their specific coding of the next gene and their specific coding of the next gene. And then what do you do? What does that mean? Does that mean you produce a lot of this or a little of this? Or so there'll be an explanation as to what all of their codings mean, and then what we do about it.
GeneRx.ca. We'll put a link in our show notes for that so people can find that. That's a really great resource. I have a question about the dopamine to norepinephrine conversion. So I've been exploring this idea of this enzyme called dopamine beta hydroxylase, which from what I understand is the enzyme that essentially converts dopamine into norepinephrine. So I've been thinking about this in terms of so you have somebody who says, I'm a dopamine junkie, right? Like I'm addictive personality. I like to do high intensity, you know, sports. I like to kite surf. I like to, you know, rock climb, all these things, right? And there's nothing wrong with those things.
Yeah.
And a lot of times what it is it's not that those people, like you said, aren't getting enough dopamine, but I find that there's a conversion to norepinephrine that possibly gives you that rush.
So there can be two sides to that dopamine junkie, and I'm certainly one of those dopamine junkies. Mine actually comes from low dopamine production and fast clearance of dopamine, so I don't even have that precursor to norepinephrine to get that high from it. So I have to push my body faster, harder. Fortuitously, I've never gone down the alcoholic, drugaholic, that sort of, but I am addicted to the highs of like the kite surfing, etc. Because I'm looking for that adrenaline norepi rush. Now there's that set of genes, and that can be a precursor to it. And then there can be, you might be absolutely fine. I'm absolutely fine in my conversion of dopamine into norepi, but I'm low on the dopamine side. So this is where I need to boost. Mm-hmm. But then there's people who make a ton of dopamine. They don't clear it up, but you're absolutely right. Through dopamine hydroxylase, they cannot get it over into norepi. And that's there's another gene called ANKK1H, which will also talk, there's a couple of genes, but that's a really big one, which talks about its conversion into norepi. And if they can't convert over, they still don't get that high. And that's actually where you want to go back to the stress genes and take a look at those as well and see how they're clearing out their stress hormones, particularly the adrenaline, noradrenaline as well. because it becomes a little bit more difficult if they are not clearing out adrenaline and noradrenaline well, and they can't turn off their HPA axis. You have to be very careful about pushing their dopamine into norepi, noradrenaline as well, because then you can overstimulate the HPA axis with too much noradrenaline and get stuck in that sympathetic side. And when we're stuck in sympathetic side, we actually start to then drop our dopamine production. So it becomes, once again, this delicate balance.
Yeah. It's such a dance, right? It's such
a dance.
Because if you get too much dopamine too, I mean, that's a precursor to Parkinson's and neurological
100%.
Hey, everybody, just wanted to take a second to break away from the podcast to tell you about my favorite pre-formulated nootropic stack. That is MindLab Pro. I look at MindLab Pro kind of like a nootropic multivitamin. If you're a nootropic newbie, this is a great nootropic stack to start with. Even if you're an experienced nootropic user, maybe you've been putting together your own kind of different stacks using different nootropics together, and maybe you've hit a plateau, maybe you just haven't found the one that works right for you. Maybe you found something that worked right, and then you try to pair it with something else, and the whole thing kind of fell apart, and then that original nootropic doesn't work for you. MindLab Pro is pre-formulated. It's made by scientists, so they actually pre-formulate it with the right amounts, the right ingredients, 11 research-backed nootropic ingredients, by the way, that are proven to help boost your cognition, your memory, your focus, your mood, all those benefits you look for out of a nootropic, especially a nootropic stack, you're going to get with MindLab Pro. You've got acetylcholine, which is going to boost your acetylcholine production. It's going to boost dopamine. It's going to boost your focus. It's going to boost your memory, your processing speed. You've got phosphatidylserine, which is going to help you with nerve growth factor. It's got glucose metabolism enhancement. You've got the modulation of the HPA axis. It's going to help your energy levels. It's going to help your mood. It's going to help your stress levels, which is so important. You've got Bacopa monnieri. You've got rhodiola, an amazing adaptogenic herb. You got one of the most popular nootropic or holistic nootropics out there, lion's mane mushroom. You're getting that nerve growth factor, literally growing new brain, promotes healthy brain cell function. So many amazing benefits from lion's mane. You've also got things like maritime pine bark extract, and of course, N-acetyl L-tyrosine, which is going to help boost dopamine levels, and of course, norepinephrine levels. So if you need a boost in mood, if you're dealing with some depression, if you just need to be a little bit more lively, let's say you're kind of falling apart going out in social situations, assuming you're breaking your social distancing, you're going out, you need a little N-acetyl L-tyrosine. And then, of course, one of the classic great nootropics, L-theanine. Hit that alpha brainwave, get into flow. If you're trying to pair something with coffee to take the edge off a little bit, or if you're just getting rid of caffeine in general, L-theanine is a great nootropic amino acid. And then you have the cofactors, the B vitamins to help really put everything together, B6, B9, B12, you know, it's like you can have all these amazing nootropics together, but if you don't turn on the fire, if you don't stir the pot, that's what the B vitamins do. They help get everything together so that it's metabolized, it hits your brain, it works the way it's supposed to do. Right now, we have a deal with MindLab Pro directly through holisticnootropics.com. You get 3 months of MindLab Pro with an extra fourth month for free. Just go on over to holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro. Again, holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro. Get one free month of MindLab Pro with the purchase of three. You can't beat this deal. The nootropic multivitamin, MindLab Pro, my favorite. Okay, let's get back into the podcast.
Our gut bacteria, the whole microbiome is such a growing and interesting field. It really can dictate how much GABA we make, how much dopamine, serotonin we make in the GI tract, whether or not we allow it to make melatonin. It really can dictate so much of that. One of the difficulties there is we don't have a lot of very specific probiotics to use as a supplementation form for that. We have a lot of good testing materials to see which our gut may be low in. But right now, to target a lot of neurotransmitters specifically, we don't have single probiotics at high enough dose just yet to target that. So what we really want to do then is just create biodiversity. So really throw in a multi-strain probio if you can't get those specific ones there. Build up that gut flora. And then feed it. People often forget about the whole feeding of the probiotics. of the microbiome. So unless you just like feeding ourselves, we're going to diminish and shrivel up. So will those bacteria in our gut. So you need to use a prebiotic, like a type of soluble and soluble fiber mix to help feed and deep feed those probiotics so they can really take a stance in the GI tract.
So are there genes that can affect, and I know the microbiome field of study is still fairly new, but do you know of any genes that kind of help or that help you understand the way your microbiome works?
So two really big ones. One is FUT2. FUT2 is one of the methylation genes as well. It also talks about the absorption of B12 through the gut, but it also talks about which microbiome it allows to let live in your gut. And it particularly likes to kill off Acidophilus bifidus and Bifidobacterium. And then there's one called NOD1, a different gene. And NOD1 talks about how quickly it allow a bad bacteria to proliferate in the GI tract, and it will wipe out all probiotics. So those are sort of the two bigger genes that I go to when talking about microbiome. Again, I haven't focused as much on microbiome until we get strain-specific therapies for it, then it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, the microbiome is such a complex ecosystem, and it almost seems like what we know today, it's going to be totally different a year from now.
100% it will be. Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what methylation is and then how the genes and what genes play into that process.
Absolutely. So methylation, by definition, is the addition of a methyl group or an OH group onto a compound. And what that does is it basically acts like a little bit of an on-off switch for whatever it's trying to, for that gene to methylate that process. And there's been a lot of theories that methylation is the key to absolutely everything in the body. We need to overly methylate the body. And then we sort of swung the other way and went, oh my gosh, methylation, we need to be careful with it, and over methylating can create its own problems. And it's actually, again, it's a bit of a marriage between the two. So there's MTHFR, there's two main MTHFR genes. One has more of sort of a cardiovascular effect, and one has more of an effect in terms of the production of neurotransmitters. So if you really increase overall methylation and you hype up the production of neurotransmitters, you need to make sure you know what all of your neurotransmitter genes are doing. Because what if you now start stimulating increased production of adrenaline and noradrenaline? Or what if you start stimulating your FKBP5, which is a protein which blocks receptors on the hypothalamus so you can't shut off the HPA axis? So you always have to look at what your possible outcome of treating any gene is. And with methylation, you can affect almost every gene in the body. It's kind of like cortisol. Stress will also affect almost every gene in the body. So when you're talking about, say, carbohydrate genes, how much insulin do we make for carbohydrate consumption, or how much inflammation do we make, or do we stimulate, say, P13K pathways, cancerous pathways, on consumption of carbohydrates? It's a little less, quote, dangerous, if you will, because you're really only talking about your dietary genes there and the body's response to carbohydrates. But when you're talking about methylation and you up methylation in the body, you're now affecting everything. So to treat methylation just on its own, without, again, looking at all of the different genes that it's going to affect and how somebody codes for that, you need to be really careful.
Yeah. So it kind of gets into that conversation of, well, what do you do about that, right? It's like, do you, because I mean, I've gone down this rabbit hole of, okay, do I supplement with methylfolate? You know, do I supplement with B12? Do I just eat more red meat? Do I eat more leafy greens? And I mean, I'm a food first type person, but you know, I know there are people in certain circumstances, and I believe I've heard that, you know, you can kind of tell if somebody is lacking in methylation by homocysteine production. Yep. But then I've also heard it was one of the metals, which arsenic. I've heard arsenic can build up with under methylation. Are you familiar with that at all?
Absolutely. So the arsenic one, so that comes from MTHFR. So again, the folic acid, or folic acid gene, folate gene, and it's one of the genes that does help to clear out with GSTP1, one of our phase 2 detoxification genes, arsenic. So the MTHFR gene will start to really stimulate GSTP1 to help clear it out. There were some really great studies on pregnant women who in Mexico, they looked at their methylation rates and they were exposed to low levels of arsenic in their water. And then they compared their methylation rates to what happened with their children to those with women who had no arsenic exposure. And what they found was in the women who had exposure to arsenic, but they had really variant methylation genes, those children had the lowest birth weight, the lowest head circumference, and the lowest IQs. And then when they tag teamed what was going on with their GSTP1 gene as well, so their glutathione, their detoxification genes, which should pull out arsenic, if they were also variant for those ones, there was an exponential increase in the change of the head circumference, birth weight, and IQ, i.e. the phenotype of their children. And they didn't see any of that in the women who were not exposed to the arsenic. So we really know that those were two of the key genes that are involved in that without a doubt. Folic acid is also needed to take B12 out of the blood and work together to lower homocysteine. So when you see homocysteine levels really high and you also see B12 levels high, then you know that methylation is not working right. Although the B12 is high in the blood, it's not getting to its target tissue again to perform its function with that folic acid and help get that homocysteine down.
So could that then be a deficiency of folic acid?
Could be a deficiency of folic acid, or it can also be the MTHFR gene. So traditionally, as naturopaths, we've always treated high homocysteine with folic acid and B12, but particularly the folic acid. And back then, had no idea that it was affecting methylation rates. Now we know.
So would you, okay. So if you, so what variant then are you looking for on this type of, in this scenario of MTHFR?
So MTHFR, if they're heterozygote or homozygote variant for either of the MTHFR genes, the two main ones, and also the FUT2 gene, which talks about the B12 absorption, that's where I'm going to take a look at treating. But just because we see a gene doesn't mean we're expressing it. Mm-hmm. So then what I'm going to do is look at their homocysteine levels in their blood. I'm going to take a look at their B12 levels. I'm going to take and say, okay, are we actually expressing this? Because I don't want to just throw people on supplements if they're not actually expressing a gene, if they have kept that gene in a good position. So here's where we also have to start marrying our lab results with it. And for things like methylation, it can be trickier to determine. A lot of the metabolic genes, it's easy to see. So if there are genes that talk about how much adiponectin, leptin, and ghrelin we make, our three main metabolic hormones, well, do you crave food all the time? Are you hungry all the time? Are you overweight? And you look at their genes and you can see where it's coming from. So that one's a little bit easier to tell symptomatically. Mm-hmm. Whether they've kept them in the on or off position, but it can be a little trickier with methylation genes for sure. But you want to be careful not to over-methylate.
Right. And how would over or under methylation, you think, affect mental health?
So over-methylation, I usually see stimulation with it. I usually see, and I'm actually one of those people. So I'm heterozygote for both my MTHFR genes. And before, when I was first starting into genetics, I was like, oh, I better treat that. So I got myself on methylfolate and I started feeling really overly stimulated. Not quite to the point of anxiety, but just hyped up. And then so I took myself off of it and felt much, much better. Now I understand that I was actually just hypermethylating my stress genes, which were in a better position and pushing things to more of an adrenaline side. I eat a great deal of B12 and folic acid in my diet. I'm like you. I'm always going to go to diet first in terms of treatment. So I was actually, quote, treating it myself from a dietary point of view and didn't need to go to a supplemental point of view.
Okay, that's good. I mean, because again, I think, you know, the food is packaged the right way, right? It comes in the right balance of nutrients. And, you know, we don't realize about supplements is that sometimes we could take take an issue or something we think is an issue. It's like you said, you were over methylating. Yeah. You just read that as, well, I have the MTHFR thing, so now I need to get the stuff that fixes the thing. And I've been there myself, you know. It manifests in me in sleep issues. I think, you know, I might be an over methylator and I've thrown so much stuff, including food, and supplementation that it's just, yeah, I don't feel like consciously anxious, but I can feel a bit of an overstimulation.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how I felt. And it's exactly what I used to hear from patients, you know, years and years ago when that's how I was first treating it before my knowledge sort of grew there.
So if you're looking at, you know, you're looking at a genetics report, I mean, and we're talking about different supplements that are good for different things. You know, we were talking about, for instance, the HPA axis, for instance, mm-hmm. right? So you were talking about there's genes for the HPA axis and, you know, some supplements that I personally like to work with clients on, the adaptogenic herbs, the phosphatidylserine, I feel does really well. You know, mm-hmm. in the nootropic side, you have L-theanine, which can help mm-hmm. kind of calm things. But maybe you can talk a little bit about the HPA axis, what the SNPs are you're looking for, and kind of the supplements or nutrients that go along with those.
Yeah. So this is my sort of favorite area. So the HPA axis, just to sort of jump back for any listeners, our hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. As hunter-gatherers, which biologically we still are, we're designed to hang out at the campfire all day long. We're designed for stress for an hour to go hunting. When we decide to go hunting or we have a stressor in our life, our adrenal glands, they start to produce cortisol, adrenaline, and noradrenaline. They rev the body up. They redistribute blood flow. They increase oxygenation so that we can go run and fight that tiger. As soon as we've dealt with that stressor, our stress hormones themselves bind into receptors on the hypothalamus and the pituitary, and they basically say, I'm done with the stressor, so stop stimulating my HPA axis and take my nervous system from the stress sympathetic side back to the quiet parasympathetic side. Today, though, in our society, we are bombarded nonstop with stressors, and then we also have genetic variables. So the ability to turn off that HPA axis once it's stimulated in many people is much less. So there's two really significant genes which talk about the receptors. One is called NR3C2, and this talks about how many mineralocorticoid receptors are on the hypothalamus and the pituitary to actually bind in the glucocorticoids to stop the HPA stimulation. Those people who are variant or who've taken two of the, quote, bad genes from their parents, they have very few of those receptors. So there's less space, if you will, less off switches, if you will, to turn off that HPA axis. Then there's another gene called FKBP5, and it makes this protein, this FK binding P protein, 5 protein, which blocks cortisol from binding into those same receptors on the hypothalamus and the pituitary, once again stopping the inhibition of our HPA axis. So both of those genes in the variant position, those people just live on this treadmill of being in sympathetic drive. They can speed up the treadmill by having a stressor. They can slow the treadmill down by going on holiday or deep breathing or meditation, but they're never getting off the treadmill. To get off the treadmill, we need to reset those receptors. We need to put those genes into their proper position. And all the wonderful tools that you mentioned, absolutely, the adaptogens, the theanine, which gets us out of beta wave activity really quickly. But one of my favorites is the triptych decapeptide. So it is a protein which is sequenced from milk, but it's only 10 amino acids in length. So the immune system can only identify something that's 12 amino acids or longer. So this scoots under the radar in terms of an allergenic point of view. But it's this very specific protein sequence that goes up to all of those receptors on the hypothalamus and the pituitary and resets them. So it allows and it increases their sensitivity. So it attracts those glucocorticoids into those receptors to shut that HPA axis off. It also decreases the production of CRH, cortical releasing hormone, from the hypothalamus, stopping further stimulation. And it also decreases from the adrenals the release of cortisol, adrenaline, and noradrenaline. So it targets the entire HPA axis all in one without any side effects. And it's a wonderful way to really help to reset those genes there.
Wow. Can you say the name of that peptide again?
Absolutely. So it's a triptych milk decapeptide.
A triptych milk decapeptide.
Uh-huh. Yeah, or lactium. The product that has that plus a combination of theanine in it together is called Serenitin Plus.
Serenitin Plus, okay.
Yeah, and it's certainly one of my go-tos because stress is everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly is. And you could treat all other genes in the body But if you don't treat the stress genes and you have somebody in front of you who is expressing those stress genes or making too much cortisol, cortisol will go and turn off everything that you're doing on all of the other genes. Mm-hmm. It's one of those blanket caveats. So we have to treat that. We're not designed for this world that we're living in.
I say it all the time. I used to be very anti-supplement. And in the last couple, really the last year especially, I've really grown to appreciate the supplement's role because it's like you said, we are not built. We are not built for this world, right?
No, exactly. And so we need extra support. And the other thing with supplements, particularly when you're talking about amino acids and neurotransmitters, the majority of them need to be taken on an empty stomach. Because if you take it with food, it gets lost. So I'll often have patients say to me, well, if this comes from milk, why can't I just drink milk? And so I'll say to them, well, if I wanted you to increase eggs in your diet, I wouldn't ask you to eat cake. Like, yes, there's an egg in cake, but we don't eat cake and go, oh, egg. You don't drink milk and go, oh, casein triptic decapeptide. But if you take that amino acid sequence on its own, it goes, oh, okay, precursor to go doing this and this and this. You take it with the food, it just gets lost.
Yeah. And with the amount of casein sensitive people and lactose intolerant people, you know, there are benefits in milk. There absolutely are. And if we could bypass the part that stimulates the immune system, like you said, why would you not? You know, it's like you, the HPA axis has really been, ever since I started this holistic nootropic site, the HPA axis is really one of, between that and the gut, it's like my top go-to understanding why the brain is working and why we react to certain situations like we do.
It has to be the go-to because when we're in our sympathetic side, everything is catered towards survival. So our body doesn't want any calmness. It doesn't want any serotonin. It doesn't want any sort of pleasure picking up from smelling the flowers. It's hardcore survival. Where is that tiger? From a dopamine point of view, it does not want you to focus in right on this. Because what if over here or here or here is the saber-toothed tiger? So it drops the dopamine production so that our focus and concentration is really low. And it does so to the point where our hippocampus, because it's not getting stimulated with neurotransmitters, it actually can shrink to a third of its size. Yeah. And our adrenals can grow three times their size because they're muscles, they're glands. You don't use that gland because you're blocking it because you're in stress world, you're not going to grow it.
Right.
And it's a wonderful survival mechanism for when we were hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
Problem is that we're living in this world of continual bombardment of our HPA axis, but yet we're not actually running for our lives.
Yeah. The tiger is now Twitter, the Twitter tiger.
Yeah. Exactly.
So bad.
That's a good one. I like that. But with respect to dopamine and supplementation, one of my favorite dopamine boosters is called DOPA Plus.
DOPA Plus.
DOPA Plus is by Pure Encapsulations. So it has the precursors to dopamine, the L-tyrosine, the L-DOPA itself, but it also has all the cofactors like B6 and zinc and folic acid to help take that tyrosine and L-DOPA and convert it into full dopamine. One little caveat, though, with it is it does have rhodiola in it. So rhodiola is a wonderful herb, but it will crash the COMP gene, which means it slows the COMP gene down further. So if you are normal for the COMP gene, which means really fast activity, so you're clearing out dopamine and adrenaline, noradrenaline really quickly, rhodiola is pretty good there because it slows down the clearing out of the dopamine. If, however, all of your stress genes are variant and you're making too much adrenaline and noradrenaline, and you can't stop that stimulation of the HPA axis, by crashing your COMP gene, you also mean you're not clearing out your adrenaline nor adrenaline. So if that's the case for those people who have not so great stress genes, then I'm going to use just an L-tyrosine or L-DOPA-based formula to help boost up. Some lifestyle things, though. Exercise, particularly high intensity interval training, really increases dopamine, particularly in those who are dopamine deficient. But you got to check your exercise genes to make sure you're catered towards high intensity interval training, because if you're not oxygenating your muscles or perfusing them with blood the way that they should do or have the right muscle fiber type, then that can work against you. Walnuts, really high in tyrosine as well, so they'll help to increase the dopamine. So is aged cheese, if you are like an aged cheddar, if you are okay with dairy products. Those are also two good things. And anything new, dopamine loves new. So if you're going out for a walk, don't just do the same route that you always do. Do a different route. If you take up a new hobby, learn a new skill, dopamine thrives off of anything new. So we can also start to boost dopamine up lifestyle-wise too.
You actually also made me, we're getting towards the end here, and I hate to like break into a whole new thing, but when you were talking about exercise, you made me think about BDNF and and how exercise is so good for BDNF. And I know there's a gene that codes for BDNF, which is great. I mean, that's one of the greatest just natural nootropics you can get.
It's literally miracle just generating. For the brain.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What maybe you could talk for just a quick minute about you know, BDNF, the gene that goes with it, and kind of what helps, how to kind of work with that one.
For sure. So BDNF is a gene which codes for the production of a brain-derived nerve factor itself. And what brain-derived nerve factor does is it helps increase the growth of dendrites. So it helps to consolidate memory. It helps to increase the production of neurotransmitters. It basically is what fixes the brain. So if there's an injury in the brain, basically we go through this little assessment process where our brain goes, are you really truly damaged, like damaged so much that I can't repair you? And if it is, then it goes through a process similar to apoptosis where it destroys that cell because it can't be fixed, and then we clear it away. If it decides, oh, you know what, we're not too damaged, we can fix this, then brain-derived nerve factor comes in and really heals up that area and gets it functioning again. So it's a wonderful, wonderful tool for the brain. And high-intensity interval training is fantastic for increasing that production. So is CoQ10, has a wonderful, wonderful effect on increasing it. And curcumin does as well as resveratrol. But with curcumin, there's another caveat with a different gene. One of our detoxification genes called CYP1A2, curcumin will really slow that gene down. So unless you're too fast for that gene, which is the normal position, curcumin is great for you to normalize and slow down that gene. But if you're variant where you're already slow and so you're not, your phase one detoxification processes are not great, you're actually going to increase inflammation in your body with curcumin, and then it will drop your BDNF.
Interesting. Oh, that's, yeah.
Back to that integration. Can't just look at one gene.
Well, I'm going to have to bring it back to talk more about this.
Because
I just thought of a million more questions. It's so interesting, you know, just the idea of the interplay of your personal genetics. And I feel like in this field, we're just starting to get into what this is and understanding it.
You're exactly right. And, you know, as each year goes, I learn more and more and keep modifying. And I'm so excited to keep learning about it.
I hope a lot of people listen to this and really, you know, especially the nootropic heads and the biohackers, because there's a lot of stuff going on in these fields, you know, in these niches or these categories, and people are just throwing a lot of stuff at the wall. And I feel like we would be making much more informed decisions if we just first started by understanding our blueprint, our genetic blueprint, using a resource like yours. That was GeneRx, was it?
GeneRx.ca.
GeneRx.ca. Go check out GeneRx.ca. Learn your genetics. You know, work with Penny, read her. You have a book coming out. What book is that?
Yeah, I do. It's called Fix Your Genes to Fit Your Genes, J-E-A-N-S at the end.
So we'll put a link to it in my show notes. And
fantastic. Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to leave us with before we sign out?
No, basically, you know, for me, genetics, as you talk about, is the genetic blueprint, and trying to treat the body without it is like getting your IKEA box delivered and you've got all these millions of parts, but you don't have the instruction piece or what the product is supposed to look like. And without the instructions for what makes our body grow and tick and heal, how can you stimulate the innate healing response if you don't know what your individual innate healing response is? I mean, this is to me, it is the foundation of medicine. And yes, we do have to marry it with the patient sitting in front of us, with labs, etc. But it is the foundation of who I am and why I respond to certain things versus who you are and how you respond. And I think it's a beautiful thing that we're all individual, but so are our treatment protocols.
Thanks for listening. For more brain-boosting info, in-depth articles, and show notes, check out holisticnootropics.com.